think this time I'll do a podcast.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
All right, everybody, welcome in. It is the debut of the new Awful Announcing Podcast. I am Ben Heisler. I am joined by a terrific panel to start things off today with Matt Yoder, Ken Fang, and Andrew Buchholz. The Awful Announcing Podcast is brought to you by our friends over at Clip It. If you guys ever find yourself watching sports or a movie, you see a crazy player scene that you want to post to social media, send to your friends, you need to have the Clip It app on your phone. It allows you to quickly find, edit, and clip your favorite moments from television and anything else you might enjoy on the Clip It app. You download the Clip It app today on iOS and Android. Hello, gentlemen. Good to talk to everybody today.
Good to be on with you.
Good to be with you all.
A couple things have been happening lately, and the two that I want to focus on today, the return of football. It's been back for the last couple weeks now. There's plenty of stories to dive into, and maybe we will or won't decide to stick to sports today with, of course, ESPN and politics and Jemele Hill and that fun story that's sort of turned into. So let's start a little bit with the Jemele Hill situation, and it's been craziness. It's had been going up all the way to the top, to the White House is now dealing with this situation. For those that might be new to the story, Jemele Hill sent out a tweet. It basically said that Donald Trump's opinions were in line with that of white supremacy, and it has now started to climb up the proverbial mountain. So, Matt, I'll start with you. What surprised you the most about how much this story has started to just blow up over the last week or so?
I think it was the fact that it blew up so much, and it was a story that lasted basically throughout the entirety of last week, and it just seemed to escalate day by day by day, from the initial tweets to the follow-ups to kind of Clay Travis and the right-wing brigade latching onto it, and then, of course, going all the way up to President Trump tweeting about it. Then you had the reports of Jemele Hill maybe being asked off the air and ESPN denying that, and just so many different levels to the story. And I think, to me, maybe the most fascinating thing of all was just how vocal many of Jemele Hill's colleagues, at least on-air colleagues, were in her defense. And I think had ESPN done anything more than just kind of a very gentle public slap on the wrist for those Twitter comments from Jemele Hill, there could have been an all-out mutiny at ESPN. So it was one of those stories that really was so interesting from a number of levels as it just blew up last week and appeared on CNN and all over the place in mainstream media, not just sports media.
What about for you, Ken?
I'm just amazed about how, and as Matt said, how long it lasted and how much legs that this has gone on. I mean, it's even going into this week. I mean, we had Clay Travis making appearances on Fox News and CNN, and former ESPN reporter Britt McHenry also latching onto it as well, as she is the former reporter for ESPN and now trying to become a right-wing pundit. So, yeah, and it's amazing how it's put ESPN on the defensive. And it's a story that's being owned by the right, and whether no matter where you fall, it's just amazing to see how much that and how many legs and how long it's lasted. And it's just a story that really maybe a few years ago might have not even been a story, but it's blown up into a huge one and has been dominating sports media for quite some time.
Andrew, do you think ESPN in how they handled this situation, did they handle it as right as they could? Do you feel like this could have been settled in a much easier fashion? What was your perspective of how ESPN took a situation that maybe could have been squashed at the very beginning and ultimately it started to really grow and start to become more evaluated over the last week or so?
Yeah, I think my biggest surprise was how ESPN handled this. And the thing was really, for me, the inconsistency compared to some other things they've done. This is a company that infamously suspended Bill Simmons for several weeks for just calling Roger Goodell a liar. And they've been all over the place on discipline before, so this is not particularly new or surprising from them. But I do think that the way they handled this in particular set them up for a lot more criticism, with just the statement disavowing her tweets, and then especially with the reports of them trying to take her off the air. I think Matt's comment about a possible mutiny was very accurate there, and they really could have fallen into this. In the end, I think ESPN is really trying to play down the middle on this one and trying not to alienate too many people on either side. And as a result, they're really alienating people on both sides and making everyone mad at them. And what really has fueled this was it rising to the level of Sarah Huckabee Sanders and then eventually President Trump commenting on it. Because there's a lot of journalists tweeting negative things about President Trump every single day. And that's why this has been this story for weeks.
So much of ESPN's handling of this situation and the continued fallout and drama that existed throughout the week, it was interesting to read John Oran. I think it was behind the Sports Business Journal paywall this morning, but I don't know if that'll be released later this week. But basically the belief inside ESPN that, gosh, we could have handled this stuff and the Robert Lee Virginia fiasco and all of these things that have happened recently, we could have handled it a lot better. And I think Andrew's exactly right, that it goes back to ESPN has been having these problems for years of inconsistent discipline, handling things, ironically, in a very similar manner to Roger Goodell in the NFL, where there doesn't really seem to be any kind of standard. It's just whatever happens in that moment. And it just sets you up for the Curt Schillings of the world to come out and say, well, I was fired for this. What about Jamel Hill or Bill Simmons? Or you just go on down the list. And for ESPN to not really have figured out how to deal with their personalities and social media in any kind of set standard way, we're now in September of 2017. A lot of this seems to be on their shoulders, I think, and just how they've handled it in accordance with how they've handled similar situations in the past.
I'm with you, Matt. I think the crazy part for me, I sort of look at this from a PR perspective. Okay, PR 101, like you want to be out in front of the story, right? You also want to have a level of consistency. And so when your standards are constantly changing, I think there's a lot of people that are sort of looking in the situation saying, well, maybe ESPN is getting too much of the blame, but they're certainly not blameless, and they're not blameless here. Let's make one thing clear. And the handling and the inconsistencies just continue to pile on for them. And for me, I just don't know where their standards are ultimately going to become. This is a major television corporation. How do you not have specific standards for these type of instances? Like, you would think at this point, with enough people lashing out and enough people of their own employees making statements that either go against company policy, Ken, and I'll start with you on this, how is there not something that is specific in writing from ESPN that says this is what we hold our people accountable for?
Well, ESPN has tried. I mean, they had a Twitter policy, but the problem is, and as Matt said, it's been inconsistent on how they've handled it and how they've implemented it. So when you have one person being suspended and another person being fired, but then another person not being fired, then that just causes confusion amongst the rank and file. They're saying, well, what am I supposed to do? And that's what's causing confusion around Bristol right now. And I think that, and as we said, a lot of it could have been handled better. ESPN, as you mentioned, is trying to get in front of the story, but they're, instead of being proactive, they're being reactive, and it's hurt them in the long run.
And that's the amazing thing about this one. Whenever you wade into politics, it seems like you either make the left mad or you make the right mad.
Sure.
ESPN somehow achieved making both the left and the right mad. I mean, that's some kind of special like achievement unlocked in this whole controversy. And I think it just goes back to not really having a grasp of how to handle these kind of situations. Maybe it's the sports and politics, maybe it's social media, what have you, but just that unique situation of everyone on all sides being mad at ESPN over this was really quite something.
As far as Jamel Hill goes too, I know that her and Michael Smith have a wonderful chemistry together, and I haven't had a chance to see a whole lot of The Six. It's on during the tail end of my radio show here in Kansas City. But I know that the ratings necessarily haven't been where they like it to be, but I think that they were fully invested in both of them. Having said that, because they didn't necessarily have a ton of ground to stand on ratings-wise, are you guys, and Andrew, I'll start with you on this, are you guys surprised at how much their colleagues really came to their defense and really sort of went against the network and a lot of the opinions coming from outside the company really to support and stand up for her, including the decision where a lot of her colleagues said, no, if you take Jamel off the show, we're not replacing her.
Absolutely. I think it's not necessarily really surprising, but I think it really illustrates why this is a big deal and why this is a wider controversy. Because Jemele Hill is the person who went out and made these comments, but these are sentiments that are expressed by a lot of people every day, some in the media, some outside of the media, and especially from a lot of people who are visible minorities and who feel very threatened by certain things that are going on in the news right now. And so I think that Jemele Hill speaking up on this was something that really resonated with a lot of people. And it resonated in a lot of ways because she is so prominent. Granted, you're right that her SC6 doesn't draw huge ratings necessarily. It's not the biggest thing out there, but she is quite likely the black female sports commentator with the biggest platform, certainly one of them. And so having her say this means a great deal and makes a big difference, and maybe is supported by a lot of other people who are like, well, I wish I could say that, but I maybe can't say it in those terms, but I'll stand with Jemele Hill here. Whether that's right or wrong, it's certainly a sentiment that I feel a lot of people have, and that a lot of people who are critics of this administration in general have. Is they're thinking, well, I may not have said it that way, but I agree with the sentiment Jemele Hill is expressing here, and that's part of why it became a wider moment.
The voice you just heard is Andrew Buchholz. We're talking here on the Awful Announcing Podcast. Ben Heisler with Matt Yoder, Ken Fang, and Andrew Buchholz here. Let's talk about John Skipper a little bit, the man in charge of ESPN, because he sent out a memo. They're saying that this is what we need to try and establish. And whether or not he necessarily believes what they're doing is wrong, I think it goes back to the point that we were trying to make before, right? Of ESPN needs to have a standard to be able to follow, and they'd like to be able to be looked at as a network that's discussing sports as opposed to political culture and race and a lot of other discussions outside of what they're typically used to. But an interesting thought on John Skipper, and I'll ask all of you guys here, if you're John Skipper, what would you do to change this growing idea, sentiment that ESPN maybe has this element of a liberal bias and some sort of agenda going forward? Is this something that you feel like he needs to address? Does he have enough people in charge and enough diversity at ESPN for them to say, no, we're comfortable in who we are as a company? Do you think this is something that he really needs to full on address? Or is at some point, like everything, people move on?
Here's the brutal reality, I think, for John Skipper. I'm not sure you can do anything about this now. I don't think you can put the toothpaste back in the tube on the ESPN is liberal narrative. And as crazy as it sounds, as much as it might make your skin crawl, Clay Travis and his ilk have basically won. I mean, they've succeeded in making this entire narrative, whatever credence you put behind it, if any at all, that ESPN is right next to the New York Times and the Washington Post and the mainstream or the lamestream media or whatever, that they've succeeded in basically throwing ESPN into all of that. And if you're John Skipper and you're all of the higher ups at ESPN, I don't know if there is a game plan or a blueprint to get out of that one, because every single controversy that happens, all of these instances, now all of a sudden you have, you know, the Breitbarts of the world, the Clay Travises, the Fox News, the Tucker Carlsons sprinting to every controversy. And I'll tell you this, they wouldn't be covering these ESPN stories in primetime if they weren't rating well, if there wasn't interest there. And all of a sudden, it's like you've kind of got the fresh meat and the fresh target to latch your fangs into. No offense, Ken.
No, none taken.
But I think that's the brutal reality for John Skipper. I'm not sure what you can do with it other than what he said in his statement was, look, we're trying to stay out of the political game. We as a network don't have a political bias. I mean, this is a network that hired Rush Limbaugh as an NFL countdown.
Brought back Hank Williams, too.
But yep, we're going to stand by our core values of inclusion, of diversity, of having different voices on our airwaves. And if there is anything you can applaud ESPN for the last couple of years, it has been a very intentional effort to put new voices on a lot of their different platforms. So I think he and ESPN basically have no choice but to put their head down and let whatever noise is happening out there just happen and stay true to who they are and just kind of deal with it right now.
Ken?
Yeah, I'll agree with that. The genie, you just can't put it back in the bottle once it's out there. And as Matt mentioned, the right has pretty much branded ESPN, MS-ESPN, and no matter how much they try right now, I don't think they can shake that label. They can try to hire Will Cain, who's more conservative, leans more toward the right. They can hire other people to at least to try and offset that label. But right now they've been branded that, and I don't think they can shake that label, at least for now. As Matt said, the right has won this particular story. They've owned this particular story. ESPN has been put on the defensive. They've tried ESPN PR, public relations has tried to hit back a little bit, but it's more than left jabs than left hooks right now. And right now they're not winning this one. And I don't think, as Matt mentioned, I don't think there's much John Skipper can do at this point.
I mean, you've got ESPN PR counting the number of times Clay Travis says the word boobs on the radio. If that does not mean that Clay Travis has won, I don't know what does.
Andrew, I'll give you the final word on this one.
Yeah, I think the defining comment on ESPN and politics comes from something that Robert Lipsight, the former ombudsman, said a couple of years ago, that there is no ideology of ESPN beyond the bottom line. And I think that's what ESPN would like to be true more than anything else. And that's what John Skipper would like to be true more than anything else. I think that they're having a harder and harder time doing that in 2017, though, because so many sports stories are political. Because the NCAA not holding tournaments in states with bathroom bans is an inherently sports story and a political story. Colin Kaepernick's protest, that's a sports story and a political story. You're going to have at least some level of political opinion on those if you're discussing those stories. And those opinions are going to have to be on ESPN's airwaves unless all of a sudden they're going away from debate and opinion altogether. And I think the challenge for ESPN and for John Skipper is that they've tried so hard to stick to this, we're not political, we're not political, we're not political, despite all these critics who, as Matt pointed out, have very good reasons for these rants against them, for this MS-ESPN stuff. That drives traffic, that drives page views, and it gets a lot of people to pay attention to these critics. And in the case of those affiliated with Fox, they're a direct competitor. But so I think that ESPN has already really lost a lot. They've lost a lot of the hardcore right wing. They certainly lost a lot of the people who listen to Clay Travis, who listen to Jason Whitlock, and who take their words as gospel. I think the real challenge for ESPN is that they're losing so many people on the left by trying to play it down the middle and by trying to be so completely neutral on things, even when they're getting absolutely taken down by the right wing.
So just to clarify before we move on, and I mean, I could talk about this all day, but do you think it would almost be more prevalent for ESPN to basically say, this is our lane and we're sticking to it, as opposed to trying to sort of wade in both sides here?
Well, I don't think that ESPN as a network should all of a sudden give in to what those critics say they are. I don't think that everything on ESPN is political or should become political. What I think they should do is they should say, hey, we're a network. We have people with opinions on things that are political and we stand by them. Their comments aren't necessarily the statements of ESPN. I feel like the trying to back away from these people whose opinions you're trying to promote the rest of the time, and trying to back away from them whenever they do something that's controversial like this, I don't think that serves ESPN well. And I think it especially doesn't serve them well when they're getting attacked from the White House and when they're not really standing up internally for their commentator, even when her colleagues are.
This is a major headache that he has to deal with. But just think about this year. You've got all of the layoffs. You've got all the subscriber losses. You've got to figure out a way to make this new over-the-top service a success. He has a lot more to worry about in making the Disney stockholders and his bosses there happy that the company is making enough revenue and moving forward and having a strategy to remain the self-proclaimed worldwide leader over the next 20 or 30 years than this ESPN liberal stuff. It does add to all of those issues, but I think at the end of the day, John Skipper has to be more worried about the business side of ESPN, as Andrew mentioned, the ideology of the bottom line. And when you look at ESPN, not just from the public perception and all of this drama that's happened over the last week, but going back to some of the stuff with Disney, the layoffs, etc., this has got to be the most challenging time of his presidency at ESPN, and maybe the most challenging time that any ESPN president has faced in quite some time.
I want to move on to coverage of the National Football League, but Tony Romo is now an NFL analyst, and he's now the lead NFL analyst with Jim Nantz over at CBS. And two games in, these are the nicest things I've ever heard anybody say about Tony Romo. It's certainly when you move on from the player side to the broadcast, but a lot of the times these players that are beloved tend to really just struggle, and the overwhelming amount of discussion on Tony Romo, at least through the first few weeks of the NFL season, has been nothing short of brilliant for him. I'm curious to get your guys' perspective on what you've seen from Tony Romo in his first 2 weeks in the broadcast booth.
He's the football whisperer. There's no doubt about it. I mean, for him to be able to see the play saying it's going to go left, or there's going to be a fade pass to number 16, and it becomes a fade pass to number 16 for a touchdown, that is just amazing stuff. The only other analyst that I can remember that can say a play is going to go left and it goes left was Hank Stram when he was doing Monday Night Football on CBS Radio with Jack Buck, Joe's father. So, yeah, his debut has been absolutely fantastic. We were all wondering if he was going to fail at this because, you know, no analyst has really come in off the playing field or the coaching ranks to become an A analyst right off the bat. I think Bill Walsh was the last one we could think of back in the 1990s. And Tony Romo has come in and has passed with flying colors and doing very well. And I'm actually looking forward to his next game.
Yeah, I had the joy of listening to Romo as my Saints were steamrolled by the Patriots on Sunday. It was probably the only highlight of watching that game as a Saints fan. And I can't remember, and maybe you guys would have someone else in mind, but I can't remember a rookie announcer who started off with this many positive reviews, this universally loved. And I think it's, as Ken said, his predictive ability, granted, I may not be old enough to remember the days of Hank Stram calling games with Jack Buck, but I've never seen anything like it. I think they said, Ken, you know, maybe you can help me with this, that Tim McCarver was famous for being kind of a first guess guy as an analyst. Granted, it's different for baseball. And then, of course, we all saw McCarver in later years. But when he was starting out, that he kind of had a similar quality, too. And it's just so unique to watch it in a football game, to see how the offense and defense lines up and what play is going to happen, and then be able to come back and explain why. He may not be perfect. I mean, he may not bat 1,000 when trying to predict those plays, but it has been really amazing to watch in the first couple of weeks. And I think when you add on top of that, the amount of pressure he's under, rookie analyst, number one booth right next to Jim Nantz, everyone kind of waiting to have those angry tweets and draft to fire off about, you know, throwing fourth quarter interceptions in the broadcast booth. He's done remarkably well.
Yeah, I think the thing that's been very impressive with Romo is that he's found a way to bridge the two sides of NFL commentary. There's a lot of people who want the specific insight, the tactics and the play description and so on. And then there's a lot of people who don't want the hardcore terminology. And I feel that Romo has found a way to get both of those in there, talking about what sort of thing is likely to be coming, but without just shouting spider 2Y banana all the time, like a certain John Gruden might. And so I think he's doing a very good job so far. I think where part of the improvement is that he's taking over from Phil Simms, who especially in recent years had been criticized for being way too much on the platitude side and not so much on the actual analysis and not on the actual plays. And so I think some of the great reviews are for Romo are based on who he's replacing and the change that he's bringing. But he's doing very well overall, especially given his lack of experience.
And what I really like about his style of analysis is he does have that enthusiasm, like a John Gruden, like, you know, John Madden before him. But he's also not afraid to call guys out. And it's not a love of everyone as we see on Monday Night Football, where every quarterback is enshrined in the Hall of Fame.
Boy, this Kyle Orton guy can really sling it. I got to tell you guys, Kyle Orton and that neckbeard's sensational. I'm sorry, go ahead.
But a perfect example, he pointed out a couple blown coverages by Kenny Vaccaro, who is a pretty good safety for the Saints secondary, at least as good as you can be playing for the Saints defense, and said, hey, these are a couple blown assignments. Wouldn't surprise me to see him on the bench. And there he was, sitting out a series. And now you've got all these stories about Kenny Vaccaro being benched coming out of New Orleans and the subject of trade talk. He was able immediately on the broadcast to say, look, this is his job. He blew it. He's going to have to suffer the consequences. You wouldn't see that from every NFL analyst. But he also brings that enthusiasm and joy for calling the game that you like to see so often. So I kind of love that balanced approach. And I think he just strikes the right tone so many times, in addition to the predictive plays that seem to go viral. So all around, I can't think CBS could be any happier for how this has started with Tony Romo.
No question. And tell me if you guys think I might be a little bit off on this comp here, but I mean, I grew up in Chicago with Harry Caray and Steve Stone, and you sort of had the wild nature of Harry on the call. But what I loved about Stoney was that he would take the predictive nature of it to almost an entirely different level. You'd have Harry go, two balls and two strikes on Sammy Sosa. What do you throw him here, Stoney? And then
that's not bad, Ben.
You grow up in Chicago for a while, it stays with you. But I remember just the predictive nature of Stoney would be, well, you know, Harry, if it's a 1-2 count and there's runners on second and third, he's probably throwing him a fastball. However, if it now becomes a 2-2, and he would give you just on and on and again. And I always, as a young viewer, found that to be fascinating. The comp that I think kind of works here is that it was almost as how when Fox took Tim McCarver out, I think McCarver and Chris and Phil Simms had a lot of similarities. And I think when they took Simms out and when they took McCarver out and they replaced him with Smoltz, I think it's kind of the same type of thing. Now, Smoltz has obviously been an analyst for a lot longer, but I just think in how he sets up the play and the clear enthusiasm for his broadcast and the ability to have both the predictive nature and also the ability to break down what just happened, I think that was also a move that was universally loved. And I don't know if you guys agree with the comp or not, but I mean, I don't remember a whole lot of negativity for Smoltz taking over that role with Fox with Joe Buck. And the same has sort of been said for Tony Romo on CBS.
I think why that's a good comparison. You have people now that I think feel a lot better about Joe Buck as a lead play-by-play guy with someone as accomplished and smart and incisive as Smoltz is sitting next to him. I think Tony Romo helps Jim Nantz out a lot too. I mean, he seems to have a newfound energy and excitement with him. And I mean, you hate to say that he'd be dragged down by Phil Simms over all these years, but I think having Romo there helps Nantz too. And you just sense between the pair of them that there is a new kind of energy in that top CBS booth, kind of like you see with Joe Buck and John Smoltz over at Fox.
Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the fact is that for a while, you just felt that whenever Phil Simms was talking, you just felt he was stating, one, the obvious. Two, he just wasn't really providing much insight. And you were just seeing that the game was passing him by. I mean, when Simms started back in the 1990s, he was basically the Tony Romo of then. He was doing very well. He was universally liked. Granted, we didn't have social media back then, but he was universally liked by the sports media critics. Now, Romo has come into that role. He's provided an energy, as Matt has mentioned. And I agree the fact that Jim Nantz has been energized. I mean, Jim tried to get a lot out of Phil, and I think they fell into the same trap of trying to bounce off each other. But now when you have a new partner in Tony Romo, you get a little energized, you challenge a little bit more, you ask questions more. I heard Nantz saying, what's coming up here, Tony? And I didn't really hear that from when he was working with Phil over the last 10 years.
Phil may not have known either.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so we got a couple minutes left, and there's obviously still so many other stories from the NFL broadcast booth. You had the debut of Beth Mowins, which we could do a whole other podcast on. I certainly think she was the positive highlight for me from that Monday Night Football game, with Rex Ryan and Sergio Dipp maybe being on the other side of the positivity for them. You have Fox going head-to-head with ABC for Saturday Night Primetime on the college side. Hank Williams Jr. is back for Monday Night Football. So... I will leave this part of the roundtable to each of you guys. I'm curious to get your overall, whether it be college or NFL, sort of your biggest takeaway from the first few weeks of football on television, and sort of the one big thing that stands out to you. And Andrew, I will start with you on that one.
Yeah, I think for me, the Hank Williams Jr. thing is maybe the funniest and most interesting part there, because it's something that I don't think anyone really saw coming. I mean, after Hank Williams Jr. made the comments referencing President Obama and Hitler, ESPN parted ways with him, and then everyone seemed to sort of forget about it. I don't think there's really been this huge movement or anything to put him back. And then ESPN goes and not only brings him back, but they bring him back in a way with Jason Derulo, with Flo Rida, with all this auto-tune. They bring him back in a way that even Hank Williams Jr.'s fans don't like. And I thought there was a really interesting analysis of this in this New Yorker piece I read this week on ESPN and their struggles, is that it really summarized up how ESPN is trying to be all things to all people, and as a result, they're being nothing to no one. They're really alienating everyone, and I think that's what happened with this new version of the Hank Williams Jr. theme song.
I think Beth Mowen's debut for me, and the fact that she wasn't the major story of that particular Monday Night Football late game, it was Sergio Dipp instead, but the fact that we weren't really talking about her debut where she was going to be the main story, I think that bodes well, the fact that she did so well, that she was so prepared, that she was ready to do the game. And I mean, she's, college football fans know her from the early game, whether on Saturday afternoons, whether it be from ESPN or ABC. But she came in and I just think did a fantastic job on the late game. I think a lot of the she tried to do best, do as well as she could with Rex Ryan, who I think dragged her down a bit. But overall, I think she did a fantastic job. And I'm looking forward to hearing her call my Browns this Sunday on CBS.
And for you, Matt?
You know, it's not necessarily a media-related take, but just overall at the start of the NFL and college season, maybe it's because the Saints haven't been playing so terribly in the first two games, but I've just found college football so much more enjoyable to watch versus the NFL. As a product, as the entertainment value, the different types of games you see. And I don't know if that gap has even been increasing and widening in recent years. Maybe it's some of the primetime and nationally televised games that have kind of fallen short of expectation so far with the NFL season, especially in week one once you got through the Patriots-Chiefs game. But it seems like college football always delivers, and the perfect example is even a cruddy, crummy, crappy game like Tennessee and Florida has this remarkable, miraculous ending where through the last half of the fourth quarter, you are absolutely glued to your television set. And I just think of that game and the excitement that it offered and the ending that it had. And then I look to the NFL Sunday and Red Zone's great and everyone loves their fantasy teams. But there just isn't that same sense of anything can happen in the NFL like there is in college. So I kind of find myself just gravitating more and more to the college game with each passing week and each passing year.
And right, I'll wrap this up with something that Andrew was talking about ESPN to wrap this up. And I kept on thinking about what you said, Andrew, and that great Mitch Hedberg line about how you can't please all the people all the time. And it just so happens that those people were at my show. That's sort of where ESPN is right now, is that they're trying to...
I wonder how many of those people are listening to this podcast right now.
There's probably somebody that's going, who's Mitch Hedberg? And that person, you and I will have a conversation.
I'm firing up the Wikipedia as well.
Right, exactly. It's fascinating to me that they're trying to take everybody and trying to say, we're trying to please all of you as best we can. It's just never going to happen. And I think until you as a media company really understand who you're trying to please, that's something that's going to stick with you for a long time. Guys, this is a great first start to our roundtable. Really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to doing it again. Matt Yoder, Ken Fang, Andrew Buchholz, read them on awfulannouncing.com. Follow them on Twitter. You can find Matt on Twitter at myoder84. Ken is at FangsBytes, and Andrew is at Andrew Buchholz. Me, I am at Benny Heiss. Thank you, guys. This was a lot of fun, and looking forward to doing this again soon.
Thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure, gentlemen.
This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. It is brought to you by Clip It. Remember, if you're ever finding yourself watching sports, you see something amazing that you just have to post to social media, you got to get the Clip It app on your phone today. You can download it on iOS and Android. Ben Koo's got a conversation with Looking Live, Brent Musburger. That's coming up in just a little bit here on the podcast. But up next, have a little bit of fun with our new Clip It app, including an opportunity for you guys, the listener, to win $50 in an Amazon gift card. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast, presented by Clip It. Download the Clip It app today on iOS and Android.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Ben Heisler back with you. Before we get to Ben Koo's conversation with the legend, Brent Musburger, our friends over at Clip It are giving you, the fine Awful Announcing Podcast listeners, a chance to win $50 to Amazon.com every time we do this podcast. Clip It is the premier spot to be able to send clips from your favorite sporting events, movies, and shows to all of your friends in just a snap. I do this with friends all the time. Particularly, there's one Family Guy reference that I use over and over and over again. So if you're one of your friends listening and that's something you'd like to be able to do, Clip It makes it super easy. It made it easy for me, and now they've made it even easier for you. You can download it today over at the Apple or Google Play Store, or visit clipituser.tv. And right now, joining us on the line for the debut of this new game is Mike. Mike correctly identified our guest for the debut podcast show. Mike, where are you joining us from tonight?
I'm in Chicago.
You're in Chicago. That's the city that I grew up in. What do you do out in Chicago?
I'm an attorney.
Oh, very nice. Well, I appreciate you joining us on the Awful Announcing Podcast today. So this is how the game works. I am going to play you two clips for you, courtesy of our friends over at Clip It. If you can identify them both, you'll win a $50 Amazon.com gift card. If you get just one, you still get $25. If you miss them both, then you miss out on a prize. Are you ready to go?
I'm ready to go.
Okay. All right, Mike. Here is your first clip. I need you to name the broadcaster from this epic call.
In trouble in the backfield. Wants to throw now. He's going to go deep. And I mean deep. And I mean touchdown, Florida! Tyree Cleveland in a miracle finish. A Hail Mary that's full of grace for the Gators.
So there you go, Mike. I need you to name the broadcaster in that call. Who is it?
I'll take a stab. I'll say Gus Johnson.
Oh, Gus Johnson, unfortunately, is not correct. It was the great Brad Nessler who moved from ESPN over to CBS, now calling the SEC Game of the Week. That's okay. You still have an opportunity to win $25 from Amazon.com. All you need to do, Mike, from Chicago, is name this movie, this clip, courtesy of our friends over at Clip It. Hang on.
Yeah, well, this is handmade quality goods we're talking here. Yes, well, when do you need them by? All right. Good doing business with you. Okay, listen up, everybody. Turn up your volumes. Announcement. I got good news. We're extending arts and crafts time by 4 hours today.
My fingers hurt.
What's that?
My fingers hurt.
Now your back's gonna hurt because you just pulled landscaping duty. Anybody else's fingers hurt? I didn't think so.
All right, Mike. Where was that clip from? I need you to give me a name of a movie.
That's Happy Gilmore.
It sure is Happy Gilmore. So there you go, Mike. You walk away with $25 in a gift card to Amazon.com, all just for playing our game. Enjoy the rest of your day in Chicago, and thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Have a good podcast.
So Mike from Chicago was our first-time winner. He gets $25 to Amazon.com. Thanks to our friends at Clip It. Coming up next, Ben Koo with Brent Musburger. Can't wait for this. You're listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Welcome back to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Awful Announcing Podcast presented by Clip It. Earlier, our fearless leader, Ben Koo, had an opportunity to sit down with the legend Brent Musburger, who has given up his headset for a life out in the desert. The conversation with the two of them started about how he first got started in news media.
You spent some time doing
news anchoring at CBS Los Angeles along with Connie Chung. Did you ever consider staying in news and not sports? And nowadays, when I talk to young people in journalism, a lot of folks don't really consider the local past. Do you think that's a mistake?
You know, Ben, it was a very, very interesting experience for me. And I went into Los Angeles as a sportscaster. I was doing the NFL Today on the weekend, and I would do the strip for the sports in the afternoon in Los Angeles, and I would fly out to New York on the weekends. Then the ratings, they were having a terrible time with the ratings, and a new general manager, whom I had known, and Van Gordon Sauter asked me if I'd be interested in taking a crack at the news and anchor alongside Connie Chung, who was certainly well-established in the Los Angeles area, later went on to a career at CBS News. And I said, okay, I'll do it, but I'm not giving up sports. So for a time, it was somewhat awkward at 6 o'clock as I worked with Connie because we would be dealing hard news and throwing to our reporters, one of whom, by the way, was Pat O'Brien. And after the hard news, we would go to commercial, and then suddenly I would come back and do the 3-minute strip on sports. And we were able to carry it off largely because Connie's talent in the news area, and I was perfectly willing to kind of ride along as a second fiddle. But I knew in the back of my mind, someday, some executive was going to come to me and ask me to make a choice. And Dan Sauter moved back to head up the sports division in New York, and that someday arrived. His successor came to me and said, I'd love to keep you full-time at news. We think you can do it. You'd be the anchor here at the CBS station KNXT in Los Angeles. And it took me about 10 seconds to say, you know, thanks, but no thanks. I enjoyed being an anchor. I enjoyed writing certain things. I can deal with a script on the prompter. I was pretty aware of what was going on in the world. But when you walk away from a news desk, locally or I'm assuming even at the national level, it's a bit of a downer. There's so many negative things going on in the world that you have to deal with. And in sports, there's still the joy. There's the victories. There's the things that I really wanted to be around. And so I left it. But it was a great experience. I still hear from Connie from time to time. And I wouldn't trade it for anything. But I'm glad that I went back and continued on in sports full time.
So I'm in my mid-30s, and I grew up in the Bay Area and as a Niner fan, and I think the first memory I have of you was you working with Super Bowl, I believe, for NBC Radio, in which you broke the announcement of Bill Walsh's retirement, which was something I don't think a lot of people saw coming, and it was a very emotional moment that gets played over and over again. What can you share about that moment? Did you know before asking him that question what his intention was, or was it something that you had some info on, or have you had a prior discussion with him?
You know, Ben, it was CBS Radio, and the reason why I was doing the radio, the host duties, was the fact that we did not have the telecast of that game, and so I would switch over to do radio on the Super Bowls. I had been around the San Francisco 49ers extensively for the last several years because they were so good. So we would pick them up late in the season, and we would be on location. And Bill Walsh was extremely nice to me, and I got to know him really well. And I would talk with him about things other than just professional football. I knew his passion. I knew what he had brought to the game. I had been inside enough of their locker rooms and other locker rooms that following the game, when I saw the emotion between coach and players, I knew this just wasn't the normal end-of-game situation. So I sort of gambled because I knew Bill well, and I absolutely knew how he felt about his players and what I had witnessed before they came to me and I went up on the air. A little bit of a gamble on my part. Calculated because I was pretty sure that it was coming, and even the TV replay of that, the NFL films, they use that replay that I was conducting on radio. I think some people thought I was doing the television in there, but I was not. But it was just a culmination of things, of having been around and observed him, that I felt that this was a time for Bill to step away. Great, great coach, one of the best that I was ever around, and actually changed the game of professional football with his passing tree.
One thing you're, you know, historically known for is having a lot of great historic calls and big moments. And I'm going to play you one, my favorite one, because I eventually ended up going to Ohio State. And I guess while you're listening to it, I'd ask you to think about, is there a particular big play call you're most fond of? And is there a historic play that, you know, the call you would want back? So I'm going to play you my favorite call that you've done and one that's still celebrated today.
They're going to put him up underneath center, though. They're going to show the eye back behind the fullback here at fourth down. Could be up to the offensive line. No, Prinzel's going to throw for it. Got to get it off. They go for the ball game.
Well, now that there were so many moments that I was around, it's really hard for me to pick out any one. That one was certainly memorable, and I think the reason why it became so memorable, to be perfectly honest with you, there are so many Buckeye fans around, and it honestly, here in Las Vegas, when I was down at the VSiN studio last week, a Buckeye fan who remembered it well came up to me and asked me about Holy Buckeye. So it's one that, I will say that it's one that comes up a lot because I was identified with college football so frequently, did so many Buckeye games back during the years. One of those spontaneous things, and I'm happy that people appreciate it. The other one that gets played a lot and was a different kind of an ending, which is sort of an interesting story actually, was the one down at the old Orange Bowl with Doug Flutie. Mm-hmm. Through the Hail Mary, the truth of the matter is, I did not know who caught it. There were arms and elbows and helmets and shoulder pads all over each other down in the end zone. I just knew that it was a Boston College player who had grabbed it. So the initial call on it, you do not hear Phelan's name. You hear Boston College won, and you hear the Flutie threw it down. But in the truck, in the CBS truck at the time, there was a Boston College graduate, fortunately for me. He reached over the producer's shoulder, pulled the isolated key back to me, and said, "It's Phelan, Brent, Gerard Phelan." To which, as the excitement goes on for the moment, I go back and say that it was Phelan who caught it. Years later, I'm doing a piece on the play with Doug Flutie. Look back, and I don't know, about three decades, I guess, after the play. So I tell Doug the story that I didn't know who caught it, and he breaks into laughter, and he said, "Brent, I didn't know who caught it." I said, "Come on, Doug." He said, "No." He said, "I'm walking up the tunnel toward our locker room after the victory, and I yell at my center, 'Who caught it? Who caught that pass?'" And the dude turned to me and said, "Doug, it was your roommate. It was Gerard." So I guess I wasn't the only one in the Orange Bowl that day who didn't know who had caught the ball. But the memories are great. Enjoyed the excitement and all those things that went on.
Sticking with the Ohio State theme, you had a very famous call for the end of the Northwestern game, which is probably one of the most historic bad beats ever. Do you remember calling a bad beat worse than that? And, you know, at times like that, do you find it hard to restrain yourself from really kind of getting into particulars when something like that happens?
Yeah, because I was always aware of what the situations were. And if you go back into that game, interestingly enough, Trevor Siemian was a Northwestern quarterback, and now he's doing a terrific job with the Broncos, but he was on the Wildcat team. But there was a 4th-and-1 that they failed to convert, and then Ohio State was able to take a lead, and against the spread's a different kind of a game that many people play, and of course that went the other way with that recovered fumble down in the end zone. But, you know, everybody knew that I knew and everybody else knew, and so that's about all you have to acknowledge. I mean, the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing now is that I think it's a big, big part of people enjoying sport, and that's to gamble on a game, whether it's a $5 bet with a buddy or a dinner with someone who's from the other school, or the people who bet $5,000, $10,000 out here in Las Vegas that we cover regularly now at VSiN. So it's not something that I ever avoided, and I'm always asked about that executives ever jump on you about it. And the only specific time that I was ever called into a woodshed was at ESPN following a Fiesta Bowl, when I mentioned the game was getting out of hand, Ohio State. Again, Ohio State pulling away from Notre Dame. And I mentioned the over-under number in a blatant attempt to help keep some of the audience in their seats. And I was called into the woodshed over that because I said over-under number, and I was not as subtle as my friend Al Michaels is, as he was just this last Sunday night, as a matter of fact, on the Green Bay Packers-Atlanta Falcons game. So that was my fault, and the only other time was when I anchored the NFL Today, and I knew what was coming. On the NFC Championship game at the very end, I would always give the point spread of the Super Bowl that was about to be played. And I would always get a call from one of the mucky mucks that the NFL had called and complained, and I would always say, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. And then I would do it again the next year, because I always knew that that was one of the big pieces of information that people wanted to know: who's favored and what's the point spread on the Super Bowl. Truth of the matter is, football, especially at the NFL level, would not be nearly as popular as it is today without gambling on the games. And just this past Sunday out here down at the South Point where our VSiN studios are, we were watching the early games, and somebody looked over at me and said, you know, why would anybody watch this stuff if they weren't betting on it? And we all had a laugh because the games at that point were not really outstanding.
Looking back over your recent tenure at ESPN, when I rewatched the old games from the 2002 National Championship season, which you did a lot of the games for, including the Holy Buckeye game and the following game against Illinois, which went into overtime, and then the Michigan game, what I noticed is I preferred your calls of those games opposed to the call we got from Keith Jackson in that classic double overtime game. And I think a lot of fans at that time felt that maybe you were ready for the national championship games and some of the games Keith was getting. Did you feel that way at that time, that potentially you might have been the announcer that the public might have preferred to have in those big games?
No, Ben, I never. Listen, I always felt great about whatever they were assigning me to do. I'm not one who ever sat back and said I should be doing this or I should be doing that. That's just not how I live my life. Whatever they want me to do, I saddle up and ride off and do it to the best of my ability. Obviously, I'm very pleased to get reactions like that from a lot of people. And I was especially pleased later in my career that the younger generation still had a favorable reaction to the games that I covered. Of course, the last couple of years were in the SEC down there, and I was always very pleased by that, because I tried to stay, I don't pretend to be a hipster, I don't pretend to know all the modern music or anything, but I tried to be relevant with the era, and I tried to realize what social media had done to change the way people view sporting events, how they converse with each other, and how they drive traffic from one game to the other. So I've always tried to maintain relevancy in the area of how people are viewing and digesting media today, and it's far, far different from when I started. But I've never, ever sat back and obviously I'm flattered when somebody says something like that. I'm not, you know, going to run away from that. But I'm not one who says, oh, I should be doing that, you know, somebody's over the hill or whatever. No, I don't do that. I was a good friend of Keith Jackson's. I knew that he was the number one broadcaster when I came over to ABC, and, you know, so be it.
Speaking of that social media love, I think a large part of the kind of attention and praise that you were getting when you were on the SEC network was that some of the games you were getting weren't as competitive as some of the games that you had been, you know, previously calling. Was that frustrating at all to be calling some games that, you know, by the second half they were getting a little bit out of hand?
You know, I've never become frustrated with a particular game. Would I have liked to have been doing a game that would have gone down to the last couple of minutes in the fourth quarter between numbers 1 and 2? You bet. I don't walk away from that. But when I've got a game in front of me, I'm either going to find something that's going on the field or a story about somebody. I am engaged in that game until it ends, until all the zeros are on the scoreboard and we've got the final score. I never, ever said to an analyst or anybody, what the hell am I doing here? This is ridiculous. And no, never, never.
So one thing I thought would be an interesting question is in the ESPN oral history book, Chris Berman said that he wants to be remembered primarily for NFL primetime, that you could put it on his tombstone. And it made me kind of think, with you having this, you know, illustrious career spanning multiple networks and multiple gigs, is there one in particular that you would like to be first and foremost when people kind of think of your career?
No, there's not a specific thing. There obviously, I'm going to be remembered just because of the timeliness of the NFL today, and we were the first live pregame show back in the mid-70s when we started that. So obviously that's going to be attached to my career. But if you're asking what I hope people think is that they enjoyed my voice in their living room or wherever they were watching the games that I was involved with. I just hope that I was a comfortable companion and did not intrude upon however they wanted to watch a particular game, whether it was to root for their side or to gamble on a side or just to be interested in watching what was going on and learning something about it. That would be, yeah, my number one thought would be, I hope that people think that I was a comfortable listener along the way.
I think you've likely accomplished that from the feedback that we receive often. So you've been partnered with a lot of talented color commentators. Is there anyone you enjoyed working with the most?
No, I got to tell you, I am so lucky. I have worked with some wonderful people. And I'm kind of chuckling because characters along the way. I will give you an example. Let me sort it out. Dick Vermeil, and Dick and I remain great friends to this day. When he went to Los Angeles and left the booth, it was with great reluctance, but they were up against it. They had to have a coach. And my young son worked in his scouting department. Scout actually worked for Dick in Los Angeles, and of course in year three they won the Super Bowl. But before he left the booth, to give you an idea of just how engaged Dick was in preparing for a college football game, I have said to people that if either of the head coaches in front of us on a Saturday were to be taken ill and it was an emergency, that Dick Vermeil actually could have gone to the sideline. Now, he wouldn't have been full of all the detailed information and the terminology and things, but he could have done a job managing either of the teams that were in front of us. That's how much work he would do in preparation for a game. His board in getting ready for a game, whether it was a Rose Bowl game or just a September game in Iowa City, they actually should retire one of them to the College Football Hall of Fame down in Atlanta, because no one ever did more homework getting ready for a game. So we were actually doing a game in, I think it was Iowa City, as a matter of fact, and I can't remember who the Hawkeyes were playing. And the previous week, a long time, a red hat, we call them, who's the person who goes out on the field, actually stands on the field of play until the commercial is over and the producer tells him to signal to the referee that to go ahead with the game. And this was a legendary red hat who had worked in the initial days of Monday Night Football with Howard and Frank and the guys. And he'd also come to us on Saturday afternoon. And he was 75, 77 years old, something like that. And unfortunately, he'd been ill for a while, and he passed away that week of the game. And so the producer and everybody at the production meeting, Jack Harute was our sideline guy. And we had all set up an obituary with his picture that would go up. And the way you handle that on television is you do it going into a break so that you get a little moment of silence. His picture stays up there, and then you dissolve to black, and then you pick up a commercial on the other side of it. So Jack Harute, who knew him, from way back, because he'd worked longer at ABC than I had, is down on the field doing the obituary for us. And the picture is up on the screen. And all of a sudden, in the middle of this, comes blitz, blitz. He was so involved in the football game, and we were a little delayed in getting through it, and there was something going on the field. So now we get the commercial. And I said, Dick, did you know? And then he heard what was going on in the truck, and he looked at me and he said, I didn't know he died. So he was so involved and immersed into the football game. And Jack Harute and I still to this day chuckle about that. And, you know, God love him. But Jesse Palmer, who I just completed SEC with, you know, I think he's working Good Morning America still, and he's in the studio. And Jesse had spent time in the National Football League. And I've always thought that the people who get time, even if they don't become full-time players, it's a job, and you study football. And I think the National Football League helps in that regard for the analysts who are up there. But I go to basketball. Rick Barry would come in and work the NBA with me. And of course, all the studio people through the years that I've had, it's been remarkable. It's been a great group of analysts. I got to work with Kenny Stabler once. They dropped him in for a game in Provo, Utah, of all places, and we were doing a BYU game, and I could tell that even though the great Stabler was in the state of Utah, that he was very, very able to find a saloon the night before the game. Great. I love the characters that I've worked with, and just terrific experiences.
So now that you kind of have stepped away from announcing and you're able to watch more games on Saturdays and Sundays, between college football and the NFL, is there an announcing booth that you think is the best in the game right now?
I would not be a good judge, because when we're watching in the casinos and when I'm watching in VSiN, we watch a lot of games at the same time and there is no sound. So I really don't hear these guys announcing games because I've got so many different games in front of me. Now, obviously, you know, I hear my friend Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth. At some point, I hear them on Sunday night because that game is completely in the clear. I'm exhausted from what we've gone through with all the odds and the spreads and the movement and trying to find out what's ahead of us for the next week. The other night, I got myself very deeply involved in Texas and USC. Okay, and I did happen to hear that broadcast, and I had not listened to now Gus Johnson. I knew because Gus is, you know, excitable, brings great passion to bring big plays. I know him well through the years, but his analyst Joel Klatt, I had not heard much of. Okay. And I was very impressed. You know, he plays it very low key as a partner with Gus. He lets Gus take care of the hyperbole, and that works. That works as a team. But I was struck by the fact that Joel is somebody who does a lot of homework. I really, you know, he's not one of the premier analysts. And if you go over to CBS, where a couple guys I know like very well. Brad Nessler has taken over his play-by-play over there. Yeah, Gary Danielson, who I worked with for a long time at ABC, and Gary also, Gary brings that NFL. In fact, I know NFL quarterbacks who've been ahead of him, Bernie Kosar among them, on a roster when Gary was playing. And Bernie will tell you that Gary Danielson was one of the most knowledgeable guys watching film that he was ever around. And he would help prepare game plans and things along the way. And it's clear when you listen to Gary that comes through. I also was struck. I think that Gary Danielson probably works with talent, his play-by-play man, about as well as any college analyst ever has. And I say that from experience because it was fun working with him, but you better pay attention to what he's saying. But he always paid attention to what I was doing, which is a skill. To have it, he did it with Vern, because I heard several games, because being in the SEC, I would focus in on their afternoon game before we came up in prime time on SEC. So, you know, and they do a fabulous job. And that the one thing they've got to work with now, and it's going to be a little bit difficult for them, the SEC is down, okay? The days of their dominance, that's long gone right now. And you've got Alabama and everybody else with what's going on in the conference. So it'll be interesting to watch. But there's so many, you know, there's so many talented guys out there, young guys, all the stuff that they do all weekend long. Great excitement out there.
With you not traveling to games anymore, is there any city or cities that you're going to particularly miss visiting and kind of seeing the town and the city?
Oh, yeah. This is an endless list. one that actually always surprises people is Clemson, South Carolina. And as I go into this, you have to understand that the setting for college football is special. A part of the enjoyment for me with going into these small towns like Clemson, it's not so small anymore, it's grown quite a bit. But just the passion, and I can only imagine what's going on now. They've been to the national championship 2 years in a row, split with mighty Alabama. And Tuscaloosa is, you know, football over there is a way of life. For the Tide. I mean, those people from Birmingham on down, they're hardcore Bama fans, and the barbecue and listening to the passion. And then you go to Auburn, Alabama, another great, great little town over on the Georgia border that I love to go to. You know, I could go on and on indefinitely with places. I'm going to mention a couple that I missed being in the SEC, and actually it happened a long time ago. I miss South Bend, Indiana a lot. I've enjoyed the 30 for 30 on the Catholics and the convicts. I used to love going into the Shadow of Touchdown Jesus and doing Notre Dame games. Going further north a little bit and a little west, if you were to ask me, what college would you go to now? You went to Northwestern, you've been around all of them. Where would you go to school that you didn't go to school? The two that would come to the top of my list would be Wisconsin and Clemson. And you cannot find any more diverse areas than those two. I used to, as a student at Northwestern, I was on a newspaper, and I would cover the games on the road when Parsegian was a Wildcat coach on court. And I thought it was so great that at Wisconsin, you went to the student union, and they actually had beer on tap in there. And this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. And Evanston at the time, where Northwestern is, that was a dry town. Ugh. And so I really majored in getting on the L and going down to Wrigley Field anyway. So, but coming places like Madison, and if you come out further west, because I'm a Montana guy, when the Grizz are rolling, Missoula's a great little town to go to a game. A wonderful setting and a wonderful big school is Washington. When the boats come up across Lake Washington, as you can see, I think actually, well, Starkville, Mississippi. I mean, there's a place that no one would mention but me. I love going in there. I got a little barbecue place down there on Main Street. I go down and talk to people. I think I miss the settings and the people more than anything else. The games are the games. And I, listen, you know, I got them all going on at the same time. I haven't missed those. But I really miss those small towns and all the fans and all the passionate people who are around. I could go on and on. Eugene. I've even enjoyed doing games down in Berkeley. Rather, kind of sits on its hands down there. And on through Los Angeles and Arizona and over to Texas. Down in Lubbock, it's not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. And, you know, I mean, I was Baton Rouge, oh my goodness, Baton Rouge, Cajun food down in there. And of course, we come back to a major city with a major school that does not have NFL, and that's Columbus, Ohio. That would be that and Ann Arbor. I'll never forget, it was Gary Danielson and I, actually, who had done the game. He was living in Michigan at the time, not down in Florida. And we did a game, I can't even remember who won. It was a Michigan-Ohio State game, typical great game. And I went to the airport in Columbus to fly out back home. And Gary called me on Monday. He said, "Brent, you won't believe it." I said, "What's that, Gary?" He said, I'm leaving Columbus, and I got the sports radio station on. He's a great fan of sports radio. I'm listening, and everyone in Columbus is screaming about you, saying you're pro-Michigan, you're a Michigan fan. They're all over you. I cross the border, and I turn on Detroit. And everybody up there screaming at you that you're a Buckeye fan, you love the Buckeyes, you were rooting for Ohio State. I said, "Gary, I did a hell of a job, didn't I?" So we always laugh about that. The fans, I miss the fans and the towns. Other places like Texas A&M, College Station, when the court comes in, and West Point, take from me like that. I got to do a game, and Schwarzkopf, General Schwarzkopf, gave the pep talk. And I was there on a Friday when he talked to the team, and just being there with the Hudson River out there, and the leaves were changing and everything. I mean, like I said, I could go on and on. I mean, it is really difficult for me because there are so many locations that I absolutely love. I tell people who are fans of the game, pick a location out, a different one every year, and go see a game there. You owe it to yourself. Go to these different venues around the country. Now, I got the NFL, been to all the stadiums, done that, and the execution and the level of skill, I can't compare. I mean, can't compare. The best of the best. Love it. However, the scene around the stadiums and with the enthusiasm, it does not match what you find in college football. That's the biggest difference. We get the fact how great these guys are, and I love watching them. But I'm not so sure that I wouldn't just prefer watching NFL football on television and going to college football games in person, if that makes any sense.
Well, I think for college football fans, a lot of people would agree with you. You mentioned Catholics versus convicts, and that kind of segues into this question. I've watched all the 30 for 30s. I think you're one of the most reoccurring guest interviews across the series. Is there one of those that you think is your favorite that you participated in or potentially weren't involved with? And have there been any 30 for 30 installments that you've actually opted not to participate in that you've been asked to?
No, that's a very good question. I have not seen them all. First, let me say this. But let me say this also, that the ones I have seen, and they're not just all about me, but I've enjoyed, those guys have done great work on it. And, you know, the one with Jimmy the Greek was very interesting for me. And, because I lived through the days, and, I still have a feeling of sadness for the Greek, simply because I know him, or knew him, he's passed, but he was in no way attempting to denigrate black athletes. He was trying to elevate, but he got into an area where he didn't belong. And, you know, it was kind of the first strike of political correctness when they moved on him. But I know the Greek. I knew him, and he was older. He was of the older generation. So they came through a different era in terms of relationships with minority groups. But he was not, he was absolutely positively not a racist. I mean, I knew that. And he was highly complimentary of black athletes, and whenever I was around and we were around some of the athletes, he enjoyed a good relationship with them. And that's probably the saddest point in my career, that the poor Greek got, you know, run off in that manner. And then he never was able to regain his footing. And he passed away out here in Las Vegas, somewhat of a tragic career. It's kind of interesting that I always told the Greek, Jimmy, go get an attorney. And this is when he's riding high with me on the NFL Today. I said, go out to, you know, Steve Wynn or somebody in Las Vegas and sell your name to front one of those sport books out there. I said, you know, these hotels are now putting them in and hundreds of thousands of people come to Las Vegas. Jimmy the Greeks, I said, you know what a draw that would be? And all you have to do, you don't have to make a book. You don't have to go back there and work with the numbers. Just go through, shake hands with the people, and you'll live happily ever after. And he always thought that violated something. One of his, I could never, ever get him to listen to me. And to this day, and it's somewhat ironic that here I am with Visa in fronting our group down there. And every day when I am on the air, talking about gambling, and the Greek would have enjoyed it.
Well, I know we're a little bit over time, but I did want to ask you a few questions, give a few moments on VSIN and what you're doing now. Would love to hear kind of the overview and the origins of this VSIN and how it was pitched to you and how you came to be involved, and, you know, the decision you made to kind of walk away from announcing to focus on this full time.
Well, that's a multi-level question, and my nephew Brian Musburger, brother Todd's oldest son, came to me, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, and mentioned that he thought that most of the information out there about gambling on sports was either done in kind of a sly fashion like I was doing or Al Michaels, or somebody selling picks, give me 50 bucks and I'll give you an automatic winner. And that they needed a group, and I didn't disagree with that at all. So he kind of said, well, you know, I'd be interested in seeing if I can start a company. And I said, you know, you don't just walk into the desert and start a company like that. I said, I know some of the players out there. I said, I certainly don't know the corporations that, because Vegas, the biggest change with Vegas is that many of the casinos are now operated by huge public corporations. But I said, I do know of a family where some of my friends are the odds makers, that legendary gambling, sports gambling family, and that's the Gahn family out of Omaha, Nebraska. Jackie Gahn came out and founded the El Cortez, and then his son Michael took it from there, and it was the Barbary Coast and the Coast casinos, and then he merged with the Boyd casinos, and Michael hated corporate life, and he and Bill Boyd ironed out a deal in which Michael walked away from the Boyd Corporation and took over the South Point Hotel and Casino, and basically he's the boss. So basically you go to one person for a decision, and Michael Gaughan, coming from a bookmaking family, knew all about sports and had taken big bets, and through the years it was all part of the culture here in Las Vegas. So at any rate, the next thing I know, Brian called me and said, Unc, Mr. Gaughan is interested. And I thought, well, I said, that's good, Brian, that's good. I think, you know, you guys have, you know, that's a foothold. And I said, you don't deal with him. And he said, you don't understand. I said, what don't I understand? He said, we got to have you. I said, Brian, come on. I got several years left here at ESPN. I'm fine, you know. He said, no, you got to come. So I laughed. And I said, well, get back to me a little bit later. And so I came out to Vegas and went to Mr. Gaughan. And I said, well, Michael, what do you think here? And he said, I like your nephew. I'm going to try to help him. And then I knew Jimmy Vaccaro, Chris Andrews, met Vinny Maiulo, the bookmakers who were working together, and checked out the place. And the next thing I know, there was this huge studio being built right adjacent to the book. And I'm going to be perfectly honest, if it had not been for family involvement, if Brian and Todd were not invested in this company, I would not have left. But I said, okay, I've got a few years to go here. I'm 77. I like Las Vegas. I like sports gambling, but the family's involved. Let me go out and help them with this. And I have thoroughly enjoyed it. We sold our home in Florida. Arlene and I are renting a condo now in Las Vegas, but it's much closer to our properties up in Montana. So my boys, I'm much closer to them. And it was the right decision at the right time. And John Skipper, a fine gentleman at ESPN, was, even though they tried to convince me to stay, and Bob Iger called from Disney, and I appreciate all those things that they did for me through the years, but they were understanding, and they let me out of the contract, and I came out here, and we got VSiN started. We started around March Madness time, and it has been a great growth situation since then. We got Sirius XM Radio, Channel 204, and obviously we stream VSiN, VSIN.com. And the shows are up there. And just this fall, we expanded to about 12 hours of broadcasting every day. We've got a show on at 7 a.m. New York time for drive time in particular. But that's a couple of known characters out here in Las Vegas, young broadcasters, Mitch Moss and Paulie Howard. They get up at 3 o'clock and they're down in that studio at 4 o'clock. And they're putting, one of the more entertaining sports shows on the air. Down the road, if you want to talk to two guys who are getting it done in broadcasting regarding sports gambling, those are the two guys on your podcast to contact. And then following them is a fellow by the name of Gil Alexander, who is already deeply involved in podcasts. And he's an analytical bettor and a big bettor. And his theories and numbers and things are absolutely, absolutely fascinating. And the two biggest sports that are being bet on, football far and away number one, but basketball is huge. Baseball has fallen away. And then there's the specialized events, as I call them. You know, the fight that was here recently between Mayweather and McGregor generated an enormous amount of betting. It's it keeps an old guy like me stimulated. I probably do more homework now than I did the last few years when I had so much help going along and I didn't have to know things about every game that's going on and every number. I guess, you know, some people, they like to play crossword puzzles or go study movies or something, whatever interests you. Me, I'm fascinated by the numbers and the betting and I love what we've been doing. I've actually enjoyed every day. Obviously, as I've told you, I've missed the excitement, and I miss my friends. I had a lot of friends that I traveled with throughout the years. But this is stimulating. So I got new friends. And like I said, you know, everybody can come around and have a cold one with me down to South Point. And we'll talk about the week's games. And maybe, because I don't brag that I'm the world's greatest handicapper. You give me a winner. You know what I'm saying? That's what I like. So Ben, that pretty much sums it up, lad.
Let's close out with this one. I would imagine VSiN would benefit greatly from the legalization of gambling, which is something that is becoming increasingly more talked about. It seems like we're picking up pace there. You know, if you were setting the over-under on when we could potentially see that change, when do you think we could, you know, what would the lines makers and out there where you are set that at? And if you were called upon to kind of give the elevator pitch to some, you know, Senate committee, how would you lobby that it's time for us to make that change?
Well, the first thing that I would do is I would attack the main objection to betting on events. And that is obviously, but doesn't that promote fixes? Okay, that would be the first thing, and you go right at it. And Senator, the truth of the matter is that the legalized onshore bookmakers in the state of Nevada have tracked down the most recent attempt and the most recent fixes that went on in college basketball. The Arizona State scandal was caught by Jimmy Vaccaro and other bookmakers in Las Vegas who saw an unhealthy amount of money suddenly show up on games that didn't mean anything, in which you might have $500 bet, and suddenly there was $5,000, $7,000 being bet on these games. Because of computers today, Senator, the money that's being bet offshore or at other casinos in Las Vegas, instantaneously, we see those numbers come across our computers. We know how much is being bet in Costa Rica, as we know how much is being bet in downtown Las Vegas. And as soon as we see something that is completely out of whack, we shut it down, we get it off the board, and we call the leagues or the conferences, whatever the case might be. And so we are your best friend. We are your absolutely best friend, because the most important thing to us is an honest game. This is a business that we run. And so we have vigorish going on either side. If we could balance the book, although it never happens, Senator, there's always an imbalance. We're always pulling for one side because we've got more money bet on the side. However, we get paid either way. And so it is to our benefit to have honest games being run. There's a total misunderstanding about bookmakers in Nevada. We have very strict state laws. We have to report what's going on. And believe me, we're on top of this all the time. Now, after you answer his questions, and he will have several, and you ask me, I would say that with the Supreme Court hearing the appeal by the state of New Jersey to legalize single game sports wagering, whenever the Supreme Court says, let's hear that appeal, and when they don't reject it and throw it back, it means that several of those Supreme Court jurists are now willing to consider legalizing sports gambling in the state of New Jersey. Normally when they do an appeal situation like that and they're willing to, they throw it over about 90% of the time. They overturn the lower court's ruling. So given that, I believe that there's at least an 80% chance that New Jersey will be authorized. And what the public probably doesn't know is that 12 other states have now signed on with New Jersey in this appeal. So to me, it's a matter of time before it grows outside the borders of Nevada. If we have $5 billion, and that's the figure this year here in Nevada, $5 billion with a B, bet on sports in the state of Nevada, We estimate that there's 20 to 25 billion being bet offshore. And that's money that's just leaving the United States, and no state or no jurisdiction in our country is getting any benefit out of. So it is to the advantage of all of these people to get it legalized as quickly as possible, because the people that keep an eye on it, at the professional level, I haven't got an iota of doubt about honest gains. Professional athletes are paid too much money. Yes, you have to keep an eye on the collegiate activities. No doubt about it, no question about it. But the people who keep the closest eye on it, they're not the administrators in these schools. They're not seeing the money that's spent every day. It's the bookmakers who see it. They're the ones who can pick up the phone and call somebody and say, we got an unusual situation here with this team. So I think it's coming. I think it's just a matter of time. And certainly I expect VSIN to grow because of it.
Well, thank you for that answer. And I think a lot of our listeners would, you know, look forward to that day. We thank you for your time, Brent. We can find you on Sirius Channel 204, VSIN.com, Twitter, I think, is VSIN as well. And you have your own personal Twitter as well. Is there anything else you wanted to kind of plug to our audience before we let you go?
No, Ben, I've enjoyed it. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
And there you have it. Great stuff from our own Ben Koo with Brent Musburger. And that is the debut podcast for Awful Announcing. So glad that you guys were able to listen. We'll be back hopefully in a couple weeks. My thanks to Ben Koo, Brent Musburger, Andrew Buchholz, Ken Fing, Matt Yoder. Also special shout out to Will Starrett of Rockcastle Media for doing our voiceover work. My name is Ben Heisler. We will talk to you again soon. Thanks for listening.